Good afternoon. I'd like to call the House Finance Committee to order. Today is Wednesday, February 24th, 2016. The time is 2:05 p.m. Members present are Representative Wilson, Guerra, Pruitt, Kawasaki, Sadler, Thompson, Newman, Representative Guttenberg, Gaddis, Edgman. I do expect Representative Munoz shortly. On today's agenda, first we're going to take up the operating budget bill, House Bill 256. After that, we're going to have a presentation from Angela Rodell, Executive Director of Alaska Permanent Fund Corp. I have my staff available, Joan Brown and Pete Eklund, to explain a couple of the important changes and a few technical changes to the committee substitute for 256, which is our operating budget bill. Basically, this is a committee substitute that we're putting out. The reason why we're doing it the way we are is with the governor's original budget that came out. It had a lot of the governor's implementation of yet-to-be revenue sources that we haven't done yet. And so that we can develop a more clear budget on this, an operating budget, we went back to a basic budget structure. So all the governor's other revenue projections, permanent fund, that stuff has been cleaned out of this committee substitute. If and when and as how other pieces of legislation pass that are some of the revenue measures, they will be folded in towards a new committee substitute where we will put the numbers into the number section and the language section, describe how the flow of that money goes. So today, again, we're just going back to a basic bare bones type of a budget structure on the operating budget so we can continue on with our budget process. Mr. Eklund, if we have questions after this, we can ask Pete. Representative
Tom. Mr. Chairman, I move we adopt CS for HB 256 Finance 29-GH2740/S, Wallace, dated 2/23/16.
Is there any objections? Seeing no objections, committee substitute for House Bill 256 version /S has been adopted by committee, and I have staff present to explain the changes. Mr. Eklund.
Excuse me. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, my name is Pete Eklund, staff to Representative Newman and the committee. And I was just going to talk in general briefly about the changes, and then Ms. Brown was going to go into more of the details. But so, Mr. Chairman, just in general, as you stated, the governor's introduced operating budget bill in the language section had many changes to the permanent fund and how the dividend is calculated and paid out, and all predicated on the passage of his permanent fund bill. And so it wouldn't be proper, Mr. Chairman, we have three bills in committee that deal with the permanent fund, and it wouldn't be proper to pass a budget that had that presumed that a piece of legislation would pass on the order of the permanent fund. And so we've removed those transactions that the governor had, and we put in basically the basic statutory dividend calculation and the inflation proofing. And so we've put into this budget what reflects what current statute is concerning the permanent fund. And further, the other big change is we removed the dollars needed to go and issue pension obligation bonds. So those have been removed from here also, and then there's a couple technical changes. And so basically, Mr. Chairman, what you have before you is a status quo type of language section that would be under current law, and that we wanted to make those changes today, and so they didn't get lost in Monday's changes. There's going to be many more changes in a CS on Monday that incorporate the subcommittee's recommendations and other language section changes. So with that, I'll hand it over to Ms. Brown.
Yes, Mr. Chair, for the record, Joan Brown, staff to co-chair Newman. So the two big changes are that we took out all the language that referred to the Alaska Permanent Fund Protection Act. That affected the permanent fund section, Section 8. And as Mr. Eklund just mentioned, we put in the standard dividend language and inflation proofing language. You'll find that on page 53. Of the new CS. We also, related to that change, is we changed the Constitutional Budget Reserve Fund section. That's on page 72 and 73. And we went back to the standard language for subsection B, which appropriates CBR to fill a deficit. The governor's original subsection had appropriated the balance of the constitutional budget reserve fund to the statutory budget reserve fund. Also, we deleted section what had been section 28, the statutory budget reserve fund. Again, it's all related to the Permanent Fund Protection Act. And there was a contingent effect section, which also got deleted. As Mr. Eklund mentioned, we deleted the language relating to pension obligation bonds. That was found in the debt section. It's section 19. It would have been on page 64 of this version. It was on page 59 in the governor's original version. And it also affected the retirement system funding sections. And that is section 23. It's on page 70 of our new CS. We made a technical change. We deleted from section 20, the federal and other program receipt section, the reference to the Alaska Aerospace Corporation, because the Aerospace Corporation has its own section 6, which appropriates any additional revenue directly to the corporation. So it was just a redundant provision. We did make a new, or add a new section. This was a governor's amendment that we accepted. It's a new section 28 on page 73 of the bill. It repeals the language that was in House Bill 72 that was adopted in 2015 that was the permanent fund dividend transfer language. The language had an incorrect date, so we have deleted the old section, and the section that is now 8B in the CS is the correct language. And that's all the changes.
Thank you, Joan. Do we have any questions? Thank you, committee members. Is this continues to flow along? If you do have questions, I'll just, you know, make sure you get a hold of myself or Pete or Joan on this to make sure that you're aware of what goes on as we flow. Representative Guerra?
Just one quick question, Joan. Thank you. with the existing plan that we have on paying down our pension debt, what's this year's installment?
The two numbers I know, actually, I can look them up very quickly. It's $116,700,000. That's rounded. It's on page 70 of the bill, and $99 million for TERS.
Thank you. Mm-hmm.
And just on that point, Joan, Ms. Brown, I believe that since the changes that we made several years ago, and I think this is good information that the public should be aware of, so I want to bring it out right now. We deposited $3 billion we moved from the Constitutional Budget Reserve. Representative Munoz took a big part in that, carrying that legislation, I believe, and to pay down the TERS and PERS obligations. This year, our payments, as Joan said, were $117 million or so. They were expected to be over $1 billion if we would not have done that. So we saved basically less than $1 billion, more than $1 billion in this budget would have been higher if not for the work that this legislature did in foreseeing, you know, changes that we're going to have to do to try and make our budget so it's less, so we can cover the cost of the state of Alaska, just so members are aware of that. So thank you, Joan. With that, Representative Thompson.
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. Next, we're going to have the presentation on investments and structure of the Permanent Fund. Presenting in person is Angela Rodell, Executive Director, Alaska Permanent Fund Corporation, and also available with her for questions is the Director of Communications and Administration, Alaska Permanent Fund Corporation, Laura Chi, for answering questions. So, Ms. Rodell.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. We're just switching out. It looks like last year's presentation ended up on the screen. And for the record, I'll go ahead and put myself on the record. I'm Angela Rodell, and I am the Executive Director of the Alaska Permanent Fund Corporation.
Okay, we're going to call a brief at ease till we get it. We're back on the record.
Sorry. Thank you. Once again, just to be clear, I'm Angela Rodell. I'm the Executive Director of the Alaska Permanent Fund Corporation. It's a pleasure to be with the members of the committee here today. I've been asked to make a presentation about the fund and the corporation, and so I'm going to talk a little bit about the history, how we got to where we are today, what some of the things that we are doing over at the corporation in terms of management and where our asset allocation, and then talk a little bit about how we calculate inflation proofing, earnings reserve, and how the mechanics of that work, because I know that there have been a lot of questions about the mechanics of how some of this stuff works. So starting in 1969, the state of Alaska received $900 million in Prudhoe lease sale bonuses, and the state budget that year was, or the prior year's budget, was $112 million. So needless to say, for the state, this was quite a windfall, and there was a lot of discussion about what was going to happen with this new resource that had been created as a result of finding the oil reserves up on Prudhoe Bay. Moving, as that debate continued, in 1976, we finally reached a point where we were ready to take action, and the action that was taken was a constitutional amendment. And if we go back to the 1976 voter's guide, there was this statement of support from the Alaska State Chamber of Commerce, which was that the Alaska state government should set aside a rainy day fund to benefit this and future generations of Alaskans. And that future generations of Alaskans is probably why we're that future generation talking about this today and have this resource available to us today. The voters agreed by a large margin, but what's interesting to me is that there were 38,518 voters who disagreed with the creation of a rainy day fund. So it was not, by all means, a unanimous decision on the part of the state of Alaska, but it was overwhelmingly approved. And just to remind people, the Alaska Constitution is very simple, what the statement says. It's very short. A lot of what we talk about is actually the statutory constructs that have been created around the fund. The constitutional amendment is very straightforward. At least 25% of all mineral lease rentals, royalties, royalty sale proceeds, federal mineral revenue sharing payments, and bonuses received by the state shall be placed in a permanent fund, the principal of which shall be used only for those income-producing investments specifically designated by law as eligible for permanent fund investments. All income from the permanent fund shall be deposited in the general fund unless otherwise provided by law. So to me, the corporation's mission is and continues to be very straightforward, which is to invest the fund in those investments designated and that produce income for the state. So what happened next? From 1976 to 1980, Alaskans debated the fund's purpose, and really the debate was whether or not the state should create a development bank for economic development purposes in the state, or if it should be an investment fund. And ultimately, it was decided that it would create an investment fund and preserve the financial resource for future generations. In 1980, Senate Bill 161 was adopted. It created the Alaska Permanent Fund Corporation, which was specifically created to manage the investments of the fund separate from the state's other investments managed by the Department of Revenue. And this bill also created the Board of Trustees to oversee the fund and started the legal list of allowed investments. Along with that bill was Senate Bill 122, which created the Permanent Fund Dividend Program. This is a program that resides within the Department of Revenue and is operated by the Department of Revenue. So looking at our Board of Trustees, we have six board members. We have two state members and two public members. One of the state members must be the Commissioner of Revenue. The four public members are appointed by the governor. They should have experience in finance, investments, or business management. And what's noticeable about this one is that they can only be removed for cause. I mentioned earlier that when the Permanent Fund Corporation was created, it was given a legal list of investments. And over the years, it got longer and longer and more complex, that detailed list, until ultimately in 2005, the legislature chose to remove the legal list and instead impose a prudent investor rule for the corporation. So this guides the investment of funds. We have a duty of care and a duty of loyalty as fiduciaries of the fund, but now it is the Board of Trustees that makes the determination of what the asset allocation will be and maintains a reasonable diversification of those assets. So what are some of the advantages of the Alaska Permanent Fund? Probably one of our biggest advantages now is the size of the fund. It allows us to have access to investments that we might not otherwise have access to. We're allowed to take significant positions in various assets, and it also allows us to negotiate fee savings because we are such a major investor in a variety of different asset classes. One of the other advantages is our time horizon. We have no set liability. We have no period to which we're managing to. We're managing into perpetuity. And so we can tie up capital for 10 or 15 years if it's deemed prudent to do so. And the return illiquidity premium is there and justifies that. Our challenges, these are not new to you. I'm sure you've heard many of these challenges. One of them is the location. Being here in Juneau requires a lot of travel to our financial centers, and it requires us to recruit from financial centers. I think as we've grown in size and reputation, some of that has become easier. Technology has made it easier, but it's still a challenge because you want to be in the middle of the deal flow and see the transactions, and sometimes we don't have that knowledge that we would if we were located in a financial center. Flexibility is a really important challenge to highlight. New resources often arrive long after they are needed due to the lengthy budget process. Oftentimes we identify needs 18 months in advance during a Board of Trustees prepares the budget, is identifying needs, and then we go through the budget process before you. And as a result of that budget process, whether or not we have success or not success means we can either act or have to wait another year before we can convince of the need for those resources. Mr. Chairman.
Representative Guttenberg.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Are we waiting to ask questions at the end or just?
Pardon?
Okay.
Do you mind if we interrupt you?
No, not at all, Mr. Chairman.
Representative Guttenberg.
So you do a great deal of your investment is done with outside consultants and fund managers. Is the fund mature enough and large enough to bring in that expertise, to have it in-house and do that in-house instead of having it still be done outside? I'm not saying that they have to be here, because certainly some of those people need to be in the financial centers. But has the fund grown in size and that it needs that expertise in-house, and some of that would reduce expenditures for to pay the consulting fees to those managers? So have we reached any mature place like that where it's prudent to do that?
Through the chair, Representative Guttenberg, we have reached that place. We have both the time. We're a 36-year-old corporation, 40-year-old fund. We have the size. One of the things our two previous chief investment officers, Jay Willoughby and Jeff Scott, both won national awards for innovation in investment, institutional investment. They attracted and were able to recruit staff in various positions, and it's to their credit and their legacy that the fund is the size it is. The fact that it doubled in the 10 years that the legislature removed the legal list and allowed the trustees and the staff to diversify and take on different asset classes and really pursue that is a testament to the fact that we're now a $50 billion fund, and it doubled in size over that time period, despite 2009 and the things that happened. We are definitely of the maturity to bring in-house certain management We want to do it selectively and prudently, and we want to do it where we think we can really move the needle on the fund, because quite honestly, I personally am fine with paying fees if it's justifying the returns we're getting from that particular fund investment. So we don't want to just do it and then have the performance fall flat on its face. So we're doing it strategically, and we're doing it what we think is in the most prudent manner for the fund.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Representative Sadler.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Riddell, just curious, does the prudent investor rule imply any specific kinds of management policies or techniques? I'm just curious to find out how far does the reach of prudent investor rule reach? Does that dictate whether in-house or outside investment advice is better, or is it simply a matter of allocation?
Through the chair, Representative Sadler, it doesn't speak to any particular strategy, which in-house versus external would be a strategy, passive versus an active management strategy. It doesn't speak to that. It's more towards, as I said, the duty of care and duty of loyalty, and making sure you don't do anything with the fund that you wouldn't do with your own sort of personal finances, and treating it with that duty of care.
Representative Kawasaki.
Thanks. To follow up on Representative Guttenberg's question, I guess I got the flip side of that is, you know, now that we're under the prudent investor rule, have a big pot of money, I guess why wouldn't you just out, and I mean there's very specific confines of what the fund is supposed to do with a zero time horizon, as you mentioned earlier, and you just want to make money. I mean, that's now the purpose. Why wouldn't it just completely be smart to just outsource that entire function and still have a board of trustees, still have folks to, you know, manage the idea, but have a company outside doing all the management?
Through the chair, Representative Kawasaki, that's a good question, and that's a policy call, obviously, that the elected body can make. You know, it's expensive to have external management. You pay a lot more in fees, even, you know, because you have that middle manager, even if we, you know, you also, I think, by internal management, what you get is an ability to be more nimble and to be more strategic, and you're truly doing it for the benefit of the fund. The decisions we make internally are for the benefit of Alaska. We have Alaska first, second, third, and last. And when you give this money to an outside manager, they may be managing money for a number of different funds at the same time, and the decisions they're making are what's best for their business model, not necessarily what's best in the best interest of the fund. And while it may not negative on the fund, it may not be the best course of action for the fund, if I can say it.
Follow-up, Representative Kawasaki.
You know, we're researching the discussion about whether you have sort of a development bank model, the talk during 76 to 80, about whether you have a development bank, whether you try and invest a lot in your state, in infrastructure and things like that, as opposed to a fund that's principally just trying to make more money. And I guess my question is, why would it matter? Because, you know, there's a lot of things that we think we should invest because we've got this huge amount of money in the permanent fund. We say, well, it's a huge risk to invest in a LNG terminal here in the state of Alaska. That's why permanent fund board has LNG interests in, I think, New Orleans or something like that. They own a third of one of those newer LNG terminals. I guess that's my question, is if it's just money and your sole purpose is just to make more money under the prudent investor rule, I guess why are Alaskans involved in that decision? Why do Alaskans have to individually, why do people in that building down there have to make that decision?
Through the chair, it's been the policy call of the state to have the state manage it. If you don't want the state to manage it, we'll give it up. That's the only answer I can give you. I'm not sure what you're – I apologize, Representative Kawasaki. I'm not sure what you're
to start, Ms. Rodell, I think I heard the question come out of him about why aren't we having outside investment take all of it instead of having in-house investors. I think I saw some numbers, and what is the average that an in-house investor saves us over management and fees to have an outside investor take care of it?
Mr. Chairman, we have calculated that we save annually $28 million in fees by the portion of the portfolio we manage in-house.
I think that kind of where he was headed at the start. Representative Pruitt.
Yeah, and I wanted to respond to that because she just hit on it, and it's why I believe that we should move more in-house than we have fees, because if we move to a management, their goal is their commission. The people that work here, their goal is the fund. And I think as a policy call, and I know this is one of the departments that the chair has in revenue, every year we actually fight over how much we should pay and how many people should be paid by the fund. And it's paid by the fund, but these people save us a considerable amount of money. And I'm in kind of a different mindset. I think it should come more in-house, and that we have control of that. And we'd probably be a little bit more successful in increasing that amount of money that stays within the fund. So I just wanted to kind of separate myself from those comments, because I'm for the fund here, not for the managers. And that's what they would be.
I do believe that we've got like three additional investment positions in this year's budget that we're looking at to try to move forward with. Is it three?
We have six, Mr. Chairman. We have six positions. Five are investment professionals.
Okay. Representative Kawasaki.
It's just because when we look at this slide and we say that one of our challenges is that we are far away from the financial institutions in New York, that flexibility is a difficult part, and that our staff, we might not have the talent, as much talent as required. I know that we do make, it sounds like we make more money by having in-house workers doing that, but my question is, could we make more money if there were a separate fund manager outside of the state that has a good success rate doing that for us?
Through the chair, Representative Kawasaki, no, because when we look at that $28 million in fee savings and we look at the performance, and studies have shown in-house management, not just at the fund, but national studies on the difference between in-house and external management, there's usually at least 5 basis points of improved performance as a result of that in-house management. So we believe we do better. We beat the benchmark, we've been beating our peers. And so I understand the question, but I disagree with the point. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thanks.
All right, Representative Edgman.
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, perhaps just a little bit off the topic here before we get to emerge in this discussion. I just wanted the record to reflect that this committee, and I think it would be universally held, really appreciated the service of the former CEO or former head of the Perfect Fund Corporation, Mike Burns, who, of course, is no longer with us, and just so the record could reflect that. The second point would be probably distract everybody, but I had a conversation with a gentleman who had a front row seat back in those days, and he reminded me that the creation of the dividend itself was not something that was universally embraced. It took a lot of debate, took a lot of effort by the Hammond administration to make happen. They essentially had to clear the decks for a year and make it their singularly top priority. And then back to the vote itself, you know, the fact that there were 35,000 people voting against it, a lot of people felt that money should go out to public services because the state was so poor. Mm-hmm. I didn't have schools, didn't have roads, didn't have this or that. So I bring that forward not to, again, sort of distract everybody, but to maybe add sort of the gravity to the future discussions that we're going to have on endowment and what to do with this fund potentially later on in the session. It's a big deal. Back then, a bigger deal back then, I think, than a lot of people realize. It's a big deal today to make any changes to it.
Thank you, Representative Edgman. Ms. Rodell, go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. So getting into where we are at today, on this slide is our target asset allocation. As you can see, it's a very diverse allocation. We have about 36% in equities, 20% in bonds, and 12% in real estate. Those are the big chunks, followed very closely by absolute return of 11%. Then we keep about 2% in cash. TIPS, infrastructure, private equity, and special opportunities make up the balance of the asset allocation. When we're looking at our diversification, what we're really trying to target is that risk versus reward and balancing that measure. And you can see that in an effort, if we try and chase the 7, 8, 9% yields in today's market, we're going to have a risk volatility number that is too high, more than we're comfortable with. And by the same measure, if we were all in bonds, which would get us that that volatility of around 2.0, we would be looking at a 2% return, which says we need to be taking a little bit more risk. The effect of diversification, this can be a hard chart, I acknowledge, to read at times, and what I want you to do is focus on the yellow line, which is the overall portfolio, and each of the blue lines is a various asset class, and what you'll see is that at times they cross each other over the period of time, and what we're really trying to do is create an all-weather portfolio so that if equities are not performing well, fixed income is, or vice versa, and sort of making sure that no matter what's going on in the markets, we have an upside strategy or at least limiting the downside potential losses on the fund. Going into the asset class, each individual asset allocation specifically, this is the stock portfolio. As of the end of the fiscal year, June 30th, 2015, we had approximately $20.9 billion in the stock portfolio. This gives you a sense the majority of the stock is in, well, it depends on how you look at it. We have a nice about a third in the U.S. market, with two-thirds exposed to the rest of the world. But our heaviest concentration then is in the U.S. Economy. We also show this by mandate, which is the red circle, which is U.S., global, or non-U.S., and then also by management type. So you can see we try to have a little bit of all types of strategies, active, quasi-passive, and passive. Our bond portfolio composition, as of June 30th, 2015, we had $11.1 billion. You know, fixed income, the bond portfolio, this is something the corporation has had since the day we started, actually when the fund was created. It was initially just a bond portfolio. And so this is something we have managed in-house since the beginning of time with the fund. Most of it, 48%, is in U.S. corporate bonds, some treasuries, 20% in treasuries, and then we also have mortgage backs, CMBSs, a bit of non-U.S. government bonds, and then some non-U.S. corporates. So some global exposure here as well. Our real estate portfolio, I think this is one of the more interesting asset allocations that I get to talk about. We have $6.5 billion in real estate as of June 30th. We directly hold 58 properties. We also have interest in a couple of REITs. The sectors within real estate are pretty balanced. We have, the REITs, multifamily, retail, office, and we've just started increasing our allocation to industrial as we're finding more and more industrial properties that make sense for us to invest in. We've also started to expose ourselves directly to real estate investments in Europe. We have three properties that we have purchased in the last 2 years. One in Portugal, one in Spain, and one in the United Kingdom, England to be precise.
Representative Sadler has a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I understand it's not your directive, and that's kind of contrary to a previous philosophy of what the fund might be, but can you tell us how much investment the fund makes in Alaska real estate or anything Alaska-based, not because it's Alaska, but because it might rise to the level of the kind of investment you're looking for?
The only investment, over the years, we've had different investments in Alaska. We've bought and sold things over the years. Currently, the only real estate investment in our portfolio is our office building, the Gold Belt building, downtown here across from the federal building. That is the only real estate asset we currently hold in Alaska. So we do have that, and that takes me to the next page, Representative Sadler. We have properties throughout the United States, including Hawaii and other the other states as identified. The color of the circles is tied to the type, whether it's an office building, multifamily, industrial, retail, to give you a sense of the portfolio. Probably the crown jewel that we like to talk about is Tysons Corner Center in Tysons, Virginia, just outside of Washington, D.C. This was an interesting project that we first invested in 1985. We are a partner with Macerich, and Macerich is the operating entity for the mall. The mall was, in many ways, takes on a lot of firsts and is a premier. I think it has over 300 stores, 22 million visitors a year. When the Commonwealth of Virginia decided to extend the Silver Metro line from downtown D.C. out to Dulles Airport, they included a stop right at Tysons Center, and it gave us an opportunity to do our first construction development that we've entered into from the fund. So what we built at Tysons Corner and opened a year ago, you'll see on the left-hand side of the photograph is a luxury apartment, rental apartment, the Vita. To the right, that is a 22-story office building. We have two primary tenants, anchor tenants in that, Deloitte and Intellistat, which is a satellite company. And then in the lower right corner is a Hyatt Regency Hotel. And in the center, there's a plaza that connects it to the shopping center. So it's an integrated work, live, play, and we've seen a lot of success with that. So if you find yourself in Tysons Corner, I urge you to stay at the Hyatt and check it out.
Representative Wilson has a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And it's kind of on the previous slide, or, I know you have to go back to it, but I know I've asked this ever since I've been here. I think it's great that we're helping economy in other states, but I don't know whether maybe it's a statute change that we need to make, but I think it's a missed opportunity that we're not doing any investment in the state of Alaska. I mean, this is our fund. It's $55 billion. I just have trouble trying to figure out how nothing in the state for any period of time besides a building down here in Juneau would rise to the level to where it would benefit our economy and benefit the permanent fund as well. So is that just now because all that's the permit fund gets to make the decision, and it would take a policy call, statute to make that happen, or do we just not have anything worth investing in Alaska for?
Through the chair, Representative Wilson, I think it's a challenging question to answer. It's very clear in statute that we can invest in Alaska. It specifically states we can invest in Alaska, but it must meet be as good of, if not better than, an investment we can find elsewhere. So part of the challenge has been finding the quality of investments in Alaska. And we do get approached periodically with opportunities to invest in Alaska that we evaluate and look into those. And I think there has been, over the years, a concern about selling the investments or getting out of the investments and making sure that the fund continues to have the flexibility to make the investment decisions it has made and not be holding on to something that financially doesn't make sense because it's your neighbors, or because, let's face it, Alaska is a small state. So I think given the size of the fund, it gets easier and easier to have those conversations because it's a smaller and smaller percentage of the overall fund and the overall portfolio of the fund. And like I said, periodically we do get approached with opportunities to invest in Alaska, and we take those very seriously and evaluate them and compare them to other opportunities. But our number one job is to maximize income to the fund.
Follow up, Representative Wilson.
So again, maybe it's just about the definition. So I think it should be about growing the fund, absolutely, but it just seems sad that we help all these economies on this state into these cities and none here. And so I guess it just brings the question of whether we don't invest wisely here so there's nothing to get part of, or what issues there are so that we would be able to have those same opportunities, not just for our residents, but for work and all the other things that I'm sure, as what you just showed in the next slide, I can just imagine what that's done to the economy of that city.
Okay. Go ahead.
Moving on to absolute return, approximately $5.3 billion was invested in absolute return as of June 30th, 2015. We externally manage, have externally managed about $2.5 billion, and we internally manage about $2.8 billion of our absolute return portfolio. In terms of private equity, the majority, 67% of our portfolio is found here in the United States, $3.2 billion as of June 30th, 2015. These investments involve over 2,800 underlying companies. Alongside this, not only do we invest in funds now in private equity, but we've started a co-investment program where we invest directly in companies alongside a fund. So when a fund goes to invest in a company, we'll make a co-investment alongside that fund into companies. Looking at our infrastructure asset allocation, this is a smaller allocation within the overall portfolio. It was $1.5 billion as of June 30th. We have properties in the United States, United Kingdom, India, Argentina, and Canada. So, again, we're getting that global exposure. 38% was in transportation and 50% in energy. So those were the two big arenas, and then the third, water and waste management. Like private equity, we started a co-investment program in fiscal year 14, and it's currently about $35 million. And what that co-investment really does is it allows us to save on fees and still get the returns that the fund we're co-investing alongside of gets without paying the fund management fees. So it's a strategy that we're real happy with.
Representative Kawasaki.
Sure. And I think I saw a slide earlier, or maybe it was a previous administration, particularly in the infrastructure holdings and energy, where there's an LNG export facility that we're a pretty significant investor in. And this is like where it speaks to Representative Wilson's comments about why are we investing in our competitors versus investing more in ourselves. So I just wanted to point that out. Maybe you could tell us about the investment in the LNG part.
Through the chair, Representative Kawasaki, I'd actually have to go back and look for that because I'm not aware of a direct investment in the LNG. And I'm not saying it's not there. I'm just sitting here today. I'm not sure what it is. And I know we invest in a variety of different funds that have energy sector strategies. So it may be through one of those that we have this. And I will have to take a look and see what that is.
Can we go back to slide 20, please?
Sure.
Following up on Representative Wilson, you've got on this slide on private equity 2,800 underlying companies. Does that mean that you're investing loans to companies that are developing or businesses, or what does that mean?
Mr. Chairman, these are privately held companies that are looking to raise capital and not go through the publicly traded markets to do that. And we invest in funds that then capitalize these underlying companies. And they choose the companies they invest in based on a series of strategies. So, for example, I just mentioned the energy. Some are into energy. Some are into supply chain, consumer, retail, tech, biotech. I mean, you name the sector, and there will be private funds. There'll be private equity funds that are looking to invest in that arena. And so what we're doing is we're making an investment most commonly into a fund that's then picking companies to invest in.
Okay. So are any Alaska companies involved, or do we not have large enough companies in Alaska to have involvement where they're trying to raise capital?
The Alaska-based companies that have been approached. So to give you an example, Kalis, the oil and gas exploration up on the slope, Kalis was looking to raise money. Apollo is a fund that invests in exploration and development of oil and gas companies. They're primarily, a lot of their investments are in Texas, but they invested in the Kalis opportunity. Apollo is a fund that we have investments with. You know, I know we're not in the fund. I know for a fact that we're not in the fund that has the Kalis investment, but that's just because of a timing. I mean, we had already made our we had made our allocation before that became available to us. So there's ways that we can invest in Alaska companies. It just hasn't, the timing just hasn't been there yet.
And they sound like maybe they're indirect. I mean, you're going to invest in Apollo, who would then take all of their invested monies and invest in the oil company up north. Is that what you're saying?
Correct.
But indirectly, then we might end up with some of that.
Right. And as we learn about, and we have a lot of information as to what those underlying companies are, and I'm not aware of any in Alaska right now, but it's that could change.
Right. Representative Pruitt.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. I think what we're getting into is what was the crux of the discussion between 76 and 80, whether or not the fund was going to be a development bank or an investment. And we chose to go the investment route. If it was a development bank, then you would see a lot of this coming into flowing into Alaska. Instead, we asked them to go and get the largest ROI. Why does a Chinese company now own the largest dairy in Australia instead of investing it in China? Well, they felt that they would get the highest ROI for the money that they'd invest. So I think if our policy, if we wanted to totally shift the policy of the fund to a development bank, then that's a huge policy call, and we should have that discussion. But if we're going to maintain what we have for the last 30-plus years, that the permanent fund would be an investment structure, then they have to look at what we've requested of them, and that is a high ROI. And that doesn't mean that Alaska is not available. I think they've clearly stated that. They do own a property here. They should own a properties here. It's about making sure that, and I have no problem, and I want to be the first person to say, I have no problem taking money from Virginia and then spending it in Alaska. And that's what we're doing with the permanent fund. We're letting those people pay us to live where they're living so that we can then buy whatever we need, whether it's heat, other things, through our permanent funds. So I think this is the crux of that initial conversation, and we're kind of rehashing it out here. And you see why it was so complex back then. Anyways.
Thank you, Representative Sadler.
Thank you. I guess a comment then my question is, yeah, we do in the state of Alaska have made a calculation that we are going to go with an investment model for the permanent fund. We certainly do operate ADA, AHFC, yeah. AEA, ATIA, and other functions and agencies that do provide money to help develop the state's economy. My question, however, is real briefly, what is co-investment? Is that Riddell on the bottom yeah. bullet there?
So through the chair, Representative Sadler, co-investment is where a fund may identify a property, an investment, a company that they want to invest directly in. So, and rather than investing in that company through the fund, in other words, I give my money to the fund then makes that investment, we make that investment directly into the company alongside as a partner of the fund. Okay? Cool.
Follow-up, Representative
Sadler. So I'll understand that as direct investment in a private company.
Yeah, but through the chair, Representative Sadler, but we're doing it alongside. I think what's really important here is that we're doing it alongside the fund, and we're taking all the same terms and length as the fund, because when we make a direct investment, and this is why I'm clarifying, because you use the term direct investment, when we make a direct investment in a company, and I'll use Juno Therapeutics as an example, and I get to it in our special opportunity slide here, we do that on our own without a fund making that investment with us. So what the fund is doing when we do a co-investment is they're doing the lion's share of the due diligence and investigation into that opportunity before we make it. And then we agree to the same terms and get into it with them, as opposed to making a direct investment.
Representative Sadler.
Thank you. So I don't need to belabor it too much, but so it's almost like you invest in the fund and then make a side bet on the same terms directly with the. Does that be the same amount as you invest through the fund?
Through the chair, Representative Sadler. Yes, side bet's a good word because we refer to them as sidecars, actually. So that's a good way to put it. And they can be different amounts.
Thanks.
Representative Wilson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. So getting back when you said that the fund might be getting to a certain point to where maybe, and again, it's probably a policy call that let's say that up to 5% or something would be invested in Alaska that you wouldn't necessarily have to. I mean, we can't compete with Chicago or Washington, D.C. or Dallas. We just don't have the population. So to take a project here and a project there, we're going to lose every time just due to the size of Alaska. So do you see that maybe there'd be a time where the fund gets big enough, like you said, and what investments in Alaska would be a small part of the bigger fund that maybe we could, and I know it's a policy call, but a change like that could happen to maybe help boost our economy in a different fashion?
Through the chair, Representative Wilson, yes, there's a possibility for that. It's ultimately what the call of, you know, this body and the administration is. We have a very direct statutory mandate now that we follow, and we'll continue to follow until it changes. So, I mean, it's entirely possible.
Follow up, Representative Wilson.
And I appreciate that. I guess, Mr. Chair, I was just trying, you know, when you're making these decisions back when Alaska was small, not knowing how fast it may or may not grow, I don't think anybody ever thought about that we might be competing on a level where the populations of some of these cities are bigger than our entire state. So it seems some of those things seem well at the time, but I guess maybe at some point we need to revisit just to make sure that we're not hurting ourselves in other areas, and sometimes it's not just about the money.
Continue, Ms. Rodell.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Moving on to special opportunities, I talked about making direct investments and private companies. Our most recent examples are Juno Therapeutics and Denali Therapeutics. These are direct investments in, we also make direct investments in specialized funds like Dyal and Blackstone. And then as of June 30th, we had $1.9 billion. So, after we make these investments, I think probably the big question is, so what happens to the earnings, the income? How does this all work? So the first thing I wanted to talk about is the statutory net income. This is a definition that was added by that was created by statute. At the time the fund was created, the generally accepted accounting principles were very different. The definition of income for accounting purposes today now includes unrealized earnings. So the definition of statutory net income is to just account for the realized earnings and losses. So we have the principal, which is the income-producing investments. We deposit net income into the earnings reserve account, and that is the realized earnings of the fund. And that income in the earnings reserve account has been and always has been available for appropriation.
Mr. Chairman.
Representative Edgman.
Yeah, just thinking back to the discussion we had on the Governor's Permanent Fund Protection Act concept, would this flow still apply if that bill were to get enacted, the principal net income and the income to ER available for appropriation? Would that sequence still be applicable?
Through the chair, Representative Edgman, yes, it would.
So as a
Representative Edgman.
Yeah, as a follow-up then, again, back to the Permanent Fund Protection Act, it would aspires, if I remember right, to have was it four times the amount that needs to be appropriated for the annual fixed draw to be in the earnings reserve. So again, if that were to be in place, would that change the investment strategy at all for the fund?
Through the chair, Representative Edgman, at this time it is not the intent, or we don't believe it would affect a change in management of the fund. I think, you know, one of the things that we are aware of and conscious of is the liquidity and sort of making sure that we manage correctly for that draw, and whether or not it requires changes to the asset allocation within the earnings reserve is not completely clear to me sitting here today. In the statute, the earnings reserve account is to be invested like the fund. So I talk about it farther in slides, sort of how we look at it and treat investments as a result. And the question is whether or not we'd have to make some adjustments specific to the earnings reserve account because of the recognition of the demand on the account going forward.
As a follow-up, Mr.
Hedgman,
it's probably fair to say then that this topic really hasn't been fully studied by the Permanent Fund Board, or is the Permanent Fund Protection Act, it wouldn't create the fundamental change that require the board to stand back and look at all this a little bit differently? Does that make any sense?
Through the chair, Representative, it does make sense. I think what's fair to say, and the board had a meeting on Friday, this past Friday the 19th, to hear about all the bills that are being discussed about the fund and to really get an understanding of what the potential ramifications were. I think that educational workshop was very helpful in terms of sort of seeing what the potential changes in the fund balances would be over time. Callan modeled all the bills on our behalf for the trustees. And I think where we come down, where the board comes down, is that nothing's being changed about our fundamental mission, which is to manage the core and to manage the principal account. And we're going to continue to manage the principal and move it over into the earnings reserve. To the extent that changes are made to that earnings reserve account, the board will adjust as needed. But overall, right now, it would be way too premature for the board to make any adjustments or to take any action, because we do really manage that account at your request.
Thank you.
Representative Munoz.
Thank you, Angela. So of the three plans, there are various rates of return from 4.5%, I believe, to 6.5%. Of those kind of choices, do you have a kind of a comfort level with kind of where we go in terms of the conservative rate of return and the impact that that would have on the management of the fund?
Through the chair, Representative Munoz, no. Actually, all three of them are pretty close in terms of the various results, and so it's just a matter of the policy call of whether or not you want to be moving money in, moving money out, how much you want to move out. Obviously, the more you take, the faster you take it, the different the effect. But all on balance, all three of them are actually much more similar than you would expect, I think, on the face of it.
Thank you.
Representative Kawasaki.
Thank you. You mentioned that the board had actually sat and talked about the proposals that are coming forward. Did the board have a recommendation or a suggestion? And what was the discussion surrounding the deposits that are changing from 30% to roughly 25%, and then the discussion around the inflation proofing of the fund?
Through the chair, Representative Kawasaki, the board listened to all three presentations. They have no opinion. They have no recommendation. They have no preference. And there was no discussion regarding inflation proofing or deposits into the fund.
Representative Sadler.
Thank you, sir. Ms. Riddell, so you said the new current definition of statutory net income is only realized earnings. Is that correct, or is it unrealized?
Through the chair, Representative Sadler, GAAP has changed their definition to include unrealized. The statutory net income definition has stayed in place to make sure that it only includes realized earnings.
And so that's what we follow, and that's what we follow as the statutory definition.
Correct.
Okay, realized. And is there any follow-up again? Is there any specific schedule on which realized earnings are realized? Is there a schedule every year you true up, or?
Through the chair, Representative Sadler, no, we take realized earnings at the time that they're realized and account for them. So in other words, say we buy a stock and we go to sell it and there's a gain in that stock, we then post that gain into the earnings reserve account at the time it's it's taken. And then at the end of the year, on June 30th, at the end of the fiscal year, we do the calculation of statutory net income for the year, which takes into account all the realized earnings and the realized losses into the account. There's a very specific distribution formula within statute as to how much is available for distribution, available for the dividend, how much we should calculate for the inflation proofing, and so we go through those gyrations, and then we prepare our financial statements, which are in accordance with GAAP. So the GAAP income that you see is very different than statutory net income.
Okay, thank you.
All right, if members please be cognizant of the time. We're 5 minutes after three, and we've got quite a bit left to go through here. Go ahead, Ms. Rodell.
Sir, Mr. Chairman. So looking at the fund breakdown, as of June 30th, we had $45.6 billion in the principal account, $39.2 billion associated with deposits, and $6.4 billion associated with unrealized gains. Once those gains get realized, they move into the earnings reserve account. The earnings reserve account had $7.2 billion, of which $1.1 billion was unrealized gains in the earnings reserve account associated with earnings reserve account investments. So what we do is we do a pro rata share of all the assets, not cash, between the two accounts. So if we buy a share of stock, roughly if you think that there's a 75-25% split between the earnings reserve account and the principal account, you know, and that dollar share, 75 cents will buy 75 cents of it will be sourced from the principal account, 25 cents will be sourced from the earnings reserve account, and we bifurcate each investment accordingly and do a pro rata share rather than the earnings reserve buying its investments and the principal account buying its investments. I wanted to give you a sense, given the discussions around statutory net income, what that has been over the last 10 years and what the associated realized return rate is with that. As you can see, 2009 was the tough year. It probably comes as no surprise to anybody in this room, and if anyone got a dividend in 2012 and 2013, you felt the effects of this loss in the lowered dividend those years. So what do we do what have you done with that realized net income? Well, $23 billion has gone to the payment of dividends to qualified Alaskans. $16 billion has been reinvested in the principal of the fund in terms of inflation proofing. You've also saved another $4.3 billion in special appropriations back to the principal of the fund. A small amount, $536 million, has gone to the general fund to pay for legal services and lawsuits and stuff in accordance with how we allocate those out. And $6.1 billion is the undistributed realized income. So that's the money that you left behind in the earnings reserve account after paying out the dividend.
Mr. Chairman.
Representative Sadler.
Briefly, an observation. I've heard from some folks that the legislature spends every dollar available to it and wastes it. Just to clarify what I'm seeing here, it looks like there's been $16 billion of inflation adjustments that the legislature has appropriated back to the corpus, and that there's also been $4 billion of special appropriations, totaling about $20 billion the legislature could have spent but did not. Is that correct?
Through the chair, Representative Sadler, that is correct.
Thank you.
Thank you. Continue.
Inflation proofing. This provides, a deposit back to the corpus. You can see annually over the last 10 years what that amount has been. It is a calculation. We do a monthly CPI calculation for the last 2 years and then apply it against the principal amount. We're looking at, and we do this on a calendar year basis, our 2015 amount was $624. The amount calculated for 2016 that would go into inflation proofing this year is only $47 million because inflation has been so low the last 2 years. What this does is it does help to maintain the purchasing power of the corpus, and it has helped build the corpus of the fund. I think one of the things that we talk about is the principal versus the earnings reserve. And when we talk about inflation proofing, the idea was to preserve the purchasing power. And when we invest, all the gain from those investments moves into the earnings reserve account and is available for appropriation. So how do we build the corpus then? How do we get that amount to go from $20 billion to the $45 billion it is today? And the way we do that, and the only way we have to do that, is through the mineral royalty deposits that you've appropriated and any other appropriation you make to the principal. We can't get it through the buildup of wealth in that account because all that gain, even if they're inflation-proofed assets that are being invested in, all that gain in value moves and is credited to the earnings reserve account. So one of the things as you're debating various policies with regard to the permanent fund is to think about how, if and how, you want to continue the policy you've had of adding to the corpus and adding to the value of the fund itself. And while there's no need to have a mechanism, you've always just appropriated, it's something that I just put before you to think about in your debates going forward. So I think one of the interesting things about this slide, and the reason I include it, is that we've been moving a lot of money in and a lot of money out. So we've deposited over the years, you've deposited over the years over $39 billion. The market value was $45.6 billion. And as of June 30th, 2015, the value was $52.8 billion. I brought with me, just to double-check, the value yesterday, because we know that there's been a lot of different, there's been a lot of tough activity over the last couple of months. The value as of the close of business yesterday was about $50.2 billion. So we've lost a little bit in total fund value since the start of the fiscal year. So talking about, I want to go into a little more detail about how we recognize earnings and move income into the earnings reserve. So assume that the fund buys an investment for $20, and the earnings reserve reflects about 25% of the total fund. The $20 investment will be funded with $15 of principal and $5 of earnings. Let's assume that the value of that investment appreciates from $20 to $40. So we now have $20 in unrealized gains, and those unrealized gains are distributed proportionally. The principal share would now be worth about $30, and the earnings reserve share is now worth $10. This is before we take any action. So unless we sell, which allows us to realize a portion of that investment, this increased value reflects unrealized gain, not statutory net income, and no income at this point is transferred from the principal account to the earnings reserve account.
Out of curiosity, we talked about how much of a fund is lost over the last couple months. The reduction in that, is that some of that unrealized losses?
Mr. Chairman, that's correct.
So that investment is still there. It's intact. Until you sell that, it's...
Yeah. Mr. Chairman, and we always mark to market at a moment in time, right?
Right.
So, for example, on June 30th, the Juno Therapeutics was worth over $1 billion. Our cost of that investment was $129 million. It shot up over $1 billion, so we were showing on June 30th an unrealized gain. And it's now down worth around $650 or $700 million. So you've seen that unrealized gain evaporate down, but there's still an unrealized gain to be captured potentially.
Mr. Chairman?
Representative Munoz.
Thank you. Could you tell us what Juno Therapeutics
is?
I know you talked about it, yes, last year, but I cannot remember. If you would refresh our memory.
Through the chair, Representative Munoz. Juno Therapeutics was a venture capital investment. It was a strategy to fight cancer, bloodborne cancers, by using cellular technology, your own cells, to fight bloodborne cancers. It was research conducted under a joint venture between Memorial Sloan Kettering Cancer Center and Fred Hutchinson Cancer Center in Seattle, and they We invested $129 million into that venture. They were able to go to an IPO in December of 2014, and that's how we are doing the valuations now. It is a public equity holding that we currently have in that company, in that biotech company.
Continue.
So that investment that went up $40, let's say we decide it's time to harvest that gain, and we realize that the $40, $15 is going to remain in principal. Remember, that was the initial investment by the corpus. And $15 of gain that the principal portion made is then transferred over to the earnings reserve. The earnings reserve now has $25 because it has $5 of its original cost that it invested, plus $5 of its own realized gain, plus the $15 of realized gain that came from the principal account. And this is what I mean about how inflation proofing then builds up that corpus, because unless you appropriate back into the corpus, there's no way for the principal to build. Now let's talk about the flip side.
Yeah, the question, excuse me.
Just on that point, and just once again, so on the Cowan report, it talks about, the Cowan report, the one from it says it was talking about comparing each of the proposals and just projected additions and appropriations based on the inflation proofing issue, because the proposals eliminate the inflation proofing debate, and also two of them are less, you get 25% rather than 30%. So, you know, when you look at this status quo at a 10-year total in additions or additions to the reserve principal would be closer to $12.5 billion, and then closer to $3 billion for each of the three proposals. And so I'm wondering why the Permanent Fund Board didn't discuss that, especially in light of talking about increasing the principal and the value that a large principal has.
Through the chair, Representative Kawasaki, 2 points about that. Cowan assumes a 2.25% inflation rate, so that's making an assumption about inflation that, for example, we haven't seen our transfer this year is going to be $47 million. So I just want to note for the record that there's an assumption behind that $12 billion that's being generated from a 2.25% rate of inflation over the next 10 years. Secondly, it is the board's position that their role is to manage the principal corpus of the fund. What, if anything, happens to the earnings reserve account is up to this body and the administration.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Continue, please.
I thank you, Mr. Chairman. I wanted to move to capital depreciation just because I think it's important to show the flip side of what happens when an investment loses value. So assume that our $20 investment dropped from $20 to $12. The principal investment is now valued at $9, reflecting an unrealized loss of $6. And the earnings investment is valued at $3, reflecting an unrealized loss of $2. And at this point, we just, you know, should we sell or should we hold on and see if that investment recovers? Assume we conclude it is prudent to go ahead and sell that investment for the $12. What happens at that point is we return the $12 to the principal from the sale proceeds, and we move $3 from the earnings reserve back into the principal to make the principal account whole. We leave the earnings reserve with the loss then of $8. And I put a note on here that with a long time horizon, investment horizon, this activity tends to be rare, and one of the only times we've seen it recently, it was in 2009. So the earnings reserve account going forward, we do have a liquidity consideration. Some of our asset classes, like private equity, are illiquid, and because we invest the earnings reserve account alongside a portion of the earnings reserve account could be considered illiquid, and yet all of the earnings reserve account is technically available for appropriation, and that has always been the case. That's nothing new here today. And there is a volatility consideration. Both the permanent fund and the earnings reserve account are subject to the ups and downs experienced by capital markets, And going forward, do we want to continue with a long-term time horizon for the earnings reserve account? Is that going to be workable? And I think that's one of the reasons for the board's workshop on Friday was to understand what the proposals and the intent are behind those proposals. And then if and when there's a final piece of statute, what that looks like, and at that point, whether or not any actions need to be taken or adjusted. You know, the counterweight to sort of those considerations is that net income in the earnings reserve account is immediately invested alongside the main fund. It does allow it to take additional risk and therefore achieve the returns, the same returns that the principal has. The nominal value of that income remains deployed and continues to earn income until it is appropriated. We don't convert it to cash immediately and just sit on it waiting for it to be appropriated. And over the last 10 years, the fund's annualized return was 6.4%.
Ms. Rodell, I wanted to point out again, you know, the fact that just because we're showing a reduction in the principal amount doesn't mean that we have lost it. It doesn't mean we've lost that much cash. It means that we have a unrealized loss until we sell whatever that is. And looking at your 10 years at 6.4%, that's a pretty good average, because if you go back, that includes 2009 when there was a 7.86% reduction in value. So over the long term, we've always managed to bring it back up. Is that correct?
That is correct, Mr. Chairman.
Senator Sadler.
Thank you. Ms. Rodell, I'm looking at slide 32 for a second. It's an interesting calculation for how the realized earnings and so forth. My question is this: if the is the corpus of the fund really inflation-proofed? If every time there's a stock-driven gain, it gets shifted over to the earnings reserve, or does it matter if the corpus is not specifically inflation-proofed as long as the entire corpus and earnings reserve are? So I'm saying the value of the corpus every time it increases by investment in the greater economy and therefore obtains some inflation adjustment, every time you achieve that, you realize the gain and shift it to the earnings reserve. Mm-hmm. So the corpus itself is not specifically inflation-proofed. The entire earnings reserve in the corpus, does that matter?
Through the chair, Representative Sadler, I think you make a good point that under current conditions, the status quo, there's sort of a natural inflation-proofing going on within the fund and the way it's invested. I think that, you know, inflation proofing as a statutory measure came about when we were buying bonds. So you have the bonds mature and you go to buy a new bond, and it was to preserve that purchasing power. I think the challenge and the policy call for you going forward is, to the extent you start intending to draw down that earnings reserve account, and how quickly and how far down that earnings reserve account gets drawn, then you don't have it as a counterweight to what's going on in the corpus, because it's no longer just one fund. You've sort of stripped off this piece of it. Does that make sense?
Representative Guerra?
Follow-up? Could I
follow-up, Representative Sadler?
Real quick, I don't know, Angela, if you have a legal authority, do you have any questions or concerns regarding the characterization of the permanent fund earnings reserve as somehow becoming diluted or tainted with general fund characteristics under the governor's replumbing plan?
Or
anything, yeah, I guess.
Through the chair, Representative Sadler, no, I don't have any concerns or about it being tainted or no. I've said it a few times today, but we're doing what the statute requires of us, and we're investing the earnings reserve account alongside. That is an account, and I will tell you, in my prior role, it's an account that was always presented as a reserve fund. It is available for appropriation. It takes a simple majority. You could spend it at any time, and nothing about that has changed, even with the discussions being talked about in the bills, the discussion. And to the extent that the decision is made to direct other monies into that account, we will manage accordingly. So we will follow the direction. But from a legal Do I have concerns? No, I don't.
Representative Sadler.
Thank you. And do you have any other authority than what you've heard from the Attorney General's office about the legality of that? Do you have any independent authority or attorney's opinion on that?
Oh, through the chair, Representative Sadler, and maybe I misunderstood your question, but we believe we have all the legal authority we need to invest. There are statutes in place that have not been taken advantage of. For example, when the Permanent Fund Corporation was created, when the Constitutional Budget Reserve was created, and that constitutional amendment was enacted, statutes were passed to allow the Commissioner of Revenue to place that money under the Permanent Fund Corporation for management. That has been in place since 1991. That has never been utilized. So there's a lot of things that have been in place that just haven't utilized, and I believe we have all the necessary authority, and it's not our place to get into the debate about the Constitutional Budget Reserve and how that money may or may not be appropriated. That is not our purview at all.
Representative Sadler,
I want to hear a specific. And do I'm asked the question, I'm just not getting the answer. So do you have any independent authority upon which you're relying for that position, or are you relying upon the Attorney General's position?
Through the chair, Representative Sadler, we are relying on all the Attorney General positions that have evolved over the last 30 years since this has been created.
Chairman, thank you.
Thank you. Representative Garrett.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just quickly on the first question, so the 6.4% annualized return over the last decade, how does that compare to the S&P?
To the what?
S&P, sorry, the standard.
Through the chair, Representative Garrett, I'd have to go back and get that information for you. I don't have that at hand today.
Any idea whether it's above or below?
Honestly, I don't know that, and that's not part of our, through the chair, that's not a benchmark we measure against.
If you'd get that to staff, we'll get it emailed out to everybody. She'll find that number very easily.
I don't need her to do that work. Thanks, and I'm fine with the way the permanent funds have been managed. Let me ask you a couple questions about inflation proofing through the chair.
Go ahead, Representative Guerra.
So I'm not making a proposal. I just want to see whether this is worth thinking about. Obviously, the permanent fund is somewhat inflation-proofed by the royalties we put into it every year, right? My last understanding is if oil is around $40, $42 a barrel or so, that that will equal the rate of inflation. Are those numbers close?
Through the chair, Representative Guerra, I'm not sure, so I can't opine to that, but there is a sense that mineral royalties do provide some natural inflation proofing.
Thank you. And through the chair.
Representative Guerra.
And then I guess last year the inflation proofing that we added to the permanent fund from the from the general fund or CBR was roughly $624 million, roughly. my understanding is it's projected to be about $800 million this year, but I'm not sure about that.
I'll let her answer that one.
Okay,
She did tell us what 2016 is going to be.
Through the chair, Representative Garrett, we've done the calculation now for 2016, and it'll be $47 million.
Inflation is very low.
Inflation in the statutory calculation is very, very low.
Wow. Okay. Appreciate that.
Representative Guerra, I believe we had a presentation that showed that that royalties that went into the permanent fund, I think last year was like $800 million,
mm-hmm.
is what the royalty payment into the permanent fund was last year, $800 million.
Thanks. So the ultimate question then is if the state is trying to figure out its budget problem, would you have any opinion on whether just inflation proofing the permanent fund enough with royalties and additional money to meet the rate of inflation for the prior 2 years, whether that would be something reasonable until the state has enough revenue again?
Through the Through the chair, Representative Guerra, it would be a reasonable approach to take. I mean, the inflation proofing has been an appropriation that you may or may not make under the statute, and you've chosen to make it every year. Going forward under any of the proposals, you can always ask us what our inflation proofing number would have been if that statute were still in place, and you always have the power of the purse to make that appropriation should you choose to do so.
Thanks, Mr. Chair.
All right. Members, any other questions of Ms. Rodell? Angela, I think we went through all your slides.
I think we did.
I want to thank you very much for the presentation. I think that a lot of people were very interested and probably learned something. I did. All right. Thank everybody for being here today. And tomorrow, Thursday, February 25th, House Finance will meet at 1:30 p.m. right here in this room. We'll have an analysis by Economic Impacts of Alaska's Fiscal Options, Professor Gunnar Knapp, Institute of Social and Economic Research, and bills previously heard or scheduled. So I'll see you tomorrow, and with that, we are adjourned.